Hello, welcome to episode 16 of the Structure and Interpretation of Computer Programmers podcast. Once again, a bored man has got access to a microphone and will use it to be wrong on the internet. I am that bored man. My name is Graham Lee. Okay, now this episode will probably take a slightly different form than usual. I often like to look at topics that I think are timeless but are actually probably just old, like programming on a 1990s computer. This one, I think we're going to go a decade into the future, but I actually get to start with some retro anyway. My topic is motivated by current events. It's motivated by the sale of ARM holdings from SoftBank to Nvidia, and so I'm going to talk about Apple and their transition from ARM to RISC-V. I get to start with retro, as I said, so I'm going to start with a history of ARM. Now, I should mention that I did work for ARM for a very short amount of time, but I was in a section of the company that the CEO may or may not have even known existed. Certainly not anything that was in the sort of direct line of business for ARM holdings at the time. So ARM was started with a lot of British government money in Sinclair Radionics, which made very small crystal set radios, pocket calculators, digital watches, and a lot of different electronic devices. And the National Enterprise Board, which was a government, essentially sort of state aid wing, had invested a lot in Sinclair Radionics. And as results continued to disappoint, the government increased, through the NEB, increased its share of the company and tried to divest parts of it and tried to close down certain lines of business. Sinclair, seeing that this was happening, mostly around the time of the Sinclair Radionics digital watch product, which was a fairly nice looking black watch where you tapped a button and an LED display, so this was before liquid crystal, an LED display showed up the time. It had reliability problems though, and wasn't a particularly practical digital watch, and you know, this product cost Sinclair Radionics a lot of money, which motivated the NEB to step in more and to take more control of the company and to buy a larger share, eventually buying it outright and selling it to another private investor, and that company is still going today. But Sinclair saw the writing on the wall and moved a lot of his interest over to an off-the-shelf company that he'd bought and sort of held dormant for a long time, and this company became Science of Cambridge, which then became Sinclair Research. But one of the things that Sinclair took with him was this employee, Chris Curry. He had been working at Sinclair Radionics on a product called the MK14, which was a small single board computer based on an 8-bit microprocessor. If you imagine something like a modern Raspberry Pi, except that you get the board and a collection of bits and you have to solder it together, and then you have a keypad on the front where you can enter like machine language instructions in hex and then program the thing. This was a sort of kit computer from like the homebrew computing era. It was quite popular. Chris Curry and Clive Sinclair really didn't get on very well. Curry describes Sinclair in an article that I'll put in the show notes as someone who is always charging up and down, shouting and throwing his slide rule around. And the two of them disagreed very fundamentally on the MK14. Curry thought it was a product that was worth more investment and becoming like the heart of the business and developing, and Sinclair kind of thought it was a distraction. And the two fell out over this, and Chris Curry teamed up with an Austrian, Hermann Hauser, who was able to put up some funding and make some business connections, and founded his own company, which eventually took the name Acorn Computer. And there's a sort of comedy documentary of sorts on the BBC called Micro Men, which I'll put a link to in the show notes, which goes into the relationship between Curry and Sinclair in quite some detail. And there's a scene in there, in Micro Men, where the two of them have a fight in a pub in Cambridge. And this is something that did actually happen and was reported in the local newspapers. So Acorn did well with their homebrew kit computers. They did develop a sort of successor and an expandable successor to the MK14, which they called the Acorn System 1, and then went into the sort of all-in-one plastic box microcomputers, the Acorn Atom. But they really did very well, again, with British government money, because the state-owned broadcaster, the BBC, started its computer literacy project at the beginning of the 1980s, and they wanted a manufacturing partner to build a new BBC branded type of computer, model of microcomputer, that would mean that they could do this show on the BBC computer and this set of educational materials on the BBC computer, and they wouldn't have to use some tie-in with some like off-brand third-party commercial computer, and they wouldn't be seen as advertising someone else's computer. So the Acorn Proton became the BBC computer, Model A, Model B, and Acorn were the manufacturing partner for this. But it did so well, particularly in education, where most schools in Britain at the time, certainly every school that I was in the 1980s, and I moved about quite a bit during my childhood, they all had these BBC computers. One of the key engineers on these computers, all of them, but developed the Atom Basic into the BBC Basic, and was really there from the very beginning of the Acorn Proton and the BBC era, was Sophie Wilson. Now, I mentioned the Micro Men program before, and the scene where Sinclair and Curry have a fight in a pub. If you watch that scene in the program, the woman behind the bar during the fight is actually a cameo by Sophie Wilson, this early Acorn employee. And she, as I said, developed the Atom Basic into the BBC Basic for what had been the Acorn Proton and then became the BBC Micro. She used this BBC Basic to design the instruction set for their next generation CPU. They had been using the MOS Technologies 6502 CPU, but MOS had been bought by Commodore, so were competing with them. And that is a dynamic that will become important later in this story. They wanted their own CPU. The idea of RISC had been floating about in the literature for a few years, and they, well, when I say they, Sophie Wilson designed, using BBC Basic, the ARM1 CPU. She actually sort of wrote an emulator in BBC Basic, so this thing was emulated on a BBC Micro before it ever existed, before it was ever made. The ARM1 was used in the original of the Acorn Archimedes line of computers that ran the RISC OS operating system, and apparently the first prototype ARM1 CPU that was made worked perfectly first time, and there was no sort of retaping between designing the original chip and going to production. So Sophie Wilson, very capable and competent engineer, you know, like just one of these sort of geniuses of computing technology. She's currently the CTO of Broadcom. So the ARM was successful for Acorn, the Acorn RISC machine, as it was called. They started to license the design out to other companies, and eventually in 1990, renamed the Acorn Risk Machine to the Advanced Risk Machine and spun out a company, again with the help of Herman Hauser, with money that Acorn put up, and with money from Apple Computer, who needed a low-power portable CPU that they could use in their Newton handheld computers. Thus, ARM Limited was born. I've described the history of ARM from its foundation in Sinclair Radionics to its spin-out, just to show why Herman Hauser is currently talking a lot about British state intervention in keeping ARM as a domestic British-owned company and having a domestic computing ecosystem and market, much as we did in the 1980s with Sinclair and Dragon and Acorn and so on. That's, you know, very much his background in bringing these companies up is through government support, and I'll put a link to his statement about the current ARM ownership into the show notes. So there's obviously now a big jump in this narrative, because we go from ARM being spun out of Acorn in 1990 to ARM being sold by SoftBank to Nvidia in 2020. Now, I blogged, and there'll be a link to the blog in the show notes, it's called Four Armed, that SoftBank were probably going to sell ARM. They weren't ever really good sort of steward custodians of the ARM company. What they were was investors who wanted to put money up and see a return on it. And what they wanted to do was to increase the licensing costs of the ARM CPU licensing and try to extract as much licensing revenue as they could from the customers. But this doesn't support the form of ecosystem and like business relationships that ARM had built up over the preceding decades, from 1990 to like 2014, I think it was, that SoftBank bought them. So they were quite a bad fit as owners, and also facing their own problems, because SoftBank and the SoftBank Vision Fund had lost a lot of money on the devaluation of WeWork, of Uber not living up to financial expectations. They'd made a lot of big bets that hadn't paid off, and I predicted that they would sell ARM before taking it down with them. And indeed this happened. They announced that they were looking for a buyer, and I followed up on Twitter on this blog post by saying that I didn't think that Apple would be that buyer. Apple are currently facing antitrust probes on multiple fronts. There's obviously the ongoing legal case with Epic. There was the debacle over the Hey email reader. There's the ongoing European and US Department of Justice investigations. The last thing that Apple need to do in that environment is to own intellectual property that literally the only competing platform in the handheld market relies on. You know, if Samsung and Huawei and Google and HTC and Motorola all need to buy their own designs for Android phones from Apple in part, or license technology from Apple in part, to be able to make Android phones, then Apple effectively becomes the sole gatekeeper to the entire smartphone market, much more evidently in a position of market power than they already are. And so there was no chance that Apple were going to be the company that stepped in to buy up ARM. What would have been best for ARM, for ARM Holdings, and for all of the companies that depend on it, including Apple, is if a consortium had bought it and had run it as a business interest group, like modelled after, say, the Linux Foundation, which is a 501c6 not-for-profit registered in the United States. But it generally for there to be a consortium owner where the company is run for the interest of all of the companies in the consortium and in the wider ecosystem. Any one company owning Arm is bad for its business as a whole. And to understand this, you have to understand how Arm works and what its business is. Arm designs and invents innovations in the computing field. So CPU instruction sets, GPU instruction sets, memory controllers, whole systems, single board computers, applications, and so on. But they don't sell any of that. What they do is they license that technology as patents out to others who manufacture it and who rely on this ecosystem of different vendors and integrators and customization partners and consultants and so on to get the most out of the investment they've made in the Arm intellectual property. So Arm have a lot of support functions. You know, the what I worked on for Arm was debugging and profiling tools, which were part of their efforts to improve integration in the data center, which are part of supporting this big ecosystem, which is massively diverse. So, like, you know, most of what employees at Arm are doing is what would be called developer evangelism or post-sales support if they were in a software business. They're in hardware, but yeah, that's basically what most of the people are doing, is making it more valuable to buy the Arm technology or to license the Arm technology. And this is a really diverse ecosystem. You've got people whose businesses are in other chips. Intel are an Arm licensee, AMD are an Arm licensee, and so on. You have the like single board computer vendors like Rock Pro and the Raspberry Foundation. You've got people making server grade systems like Marvell with their Thunder X2 CPUs, and also the people who integrate those into say high performance computing clusters like Cray or like research establishments. Then there's like the people who make the mobile phones, Samsung, Apple, HTC, and so on. And you know, you get the idea that there's this like broad ecosystem of different businesses. But we've so far only looked at like what's effectively a third of Arm's mainstream business, because they've got three main architectures, what they call the A series, which is the application processors, which is what the CPUs in an iPhone or an iPad are, and the CPUs in an Android phone. Then they've got their R series, which is real-time computing, which is for like signal processors, the baseband computers in a mobile phone, those sorts of real-time applications. And M series, which probably stood for mobile at some point in the past and now stands for embedded, and that's not my pun, it's theirs. And that's for Internet of Things, it's for application specific uses like motion sensors and like smart devices like light bulbs and toasters and whatever. And you know, Apple like definitely use all three of these, but what we've been talking about so far is the A series, the application processor ecosystem. Then there's also like weird other organizations like in the UK, Linaro, who are effectively a sort of independent consultant. If Arm want to help someone like succeed with open source on Arm, they don't want to go in themselves and make it a first party engagement, because they want the ecosystem to succeed. They don't want to do any either vendor preference or take work away from and business away from their partners. So there's this sort of external organization called Linaro, who do a lot of work in enabling open source applications, the GCC, the rest of the GNU developer tool chain, the LLVM tool chain, the Linux kernel, device drivers, and so on. Just making sure that software applications work well if you're using them on the Arm ecosystem. And as the various licensees are very diverse, so the licensing and the business terms is as well. In looking at the application CPUs, you know, someone could purchase an architecture license, which basically gives them permission to design their own chips that are completely compatible with the ARM instruction set reference. You can also license to become a merchant foundry, which basically means that you make ARM designed reference chips. So even like the Cortex series of CPUs are not made by ARM, they are made by merchant foundries. There's also the built-on ARM licensing structure, where you can incorporate the ARM intellectual property into your own custom chip designs or build custom extensions to the ARM instruction set. So if you've got some application specific silicon that you need, but you also need to be able to use like general purpose software, then you can extend the ARM chipset or the ARM instruction set to support both general purpose ARM computing and your own applications. And then they've got a flexible model where you can take like various pieces of the ARM infrastructure and support in a kind of a la carte basis. And then when you've designed your chip and you want to like tape out a prototype, you then go back to ARM and say, this is what we've done, what do we owe you? And you know, that's designed very much for sort of silicon startups. The basic license for the instruction set for those silicon startups is zero cost for many applications, and certainly for like early stage businesses through a program called ARM Design Start. And I'll come back to why that is later in the episode. So any one licensee, you know, taking that ecosystem as a whole, if any one of those licensees owned the ARM intellectual property, it would be bad for the whole ecosystem, including for that licensee, whether it's Apple or Nvidia or someone else, because the whole thing depends on this synergistic and mutually beneficial collection of business relationships across a distributed system. You know, if one of the merchant foundries owned the ARM IP, then it would be very hard for Imagination Technologies or Nvidia or Intel to design chips that were based on customizing that IP, because they'd then be competing with that customer. Similarly, if an organization, a vertically integrated organization like Apple or Samsung owned the IP, then it would be hard for anyone to work with them, because they would be buying their core technologies from a competitor. And so this is why I suggested that the best solution for ARM would be a consortium ownership run as a business interest group or as a foundation, rather than a single corporate owner drawn from their list of existing partners. Apple and Nvidia, of course, have a historical relationship that has had its ups and downs. Nvidia have at times been Apple's preferred supplier of GPUs for their computers, and at times have been blacklisted by Apple and haven't had any of their GPUs in Apple computers. A clear example of a relationship going sour is in 2002, when Nvidia put out a press release saying that the eMac was going to use Nvidia GPUs, and it was this 17-inch CRT all-in-one computer with an Nvidia GeForce MX2 inside. And they did that before Apple had announced that the eMac existed, so they effectively got the scoop on Apple's new product launch. Unsurprisingly, Steve Jobs was very disappointed by this, and then stopped using Nvidia for their GPUs for a time. More recently, macOS Mojave dropped support for a lot of the aftermarket Nvidia GPUs, so the only ones that were supported were the built for Apple Nvidia GPUs, which were very old at the time and obviously are further from the cutting edge now. So the support for NVIDIA products in macOS is not great at the moment. Now, we don't know what relationship ARM and Apple have. We don't know what their license is. Some rumors say that they've got a perpetual license that comes from founding the company as co-investors with Acorn back in 1990. Others say that they've got a special license that they acquired when they bought PA Semi, but PA Semi were a power licensee at the time. Maybe they've got some perpetual license. We don't know, and we also don't know whether any license they've got is necessarily going to be honored by NVIDIA or the NVIDIA version of ARM, whether they negotiated this license with ARM Holdings Limited or with SoftBank, or whether there are terms including significant ownership changes to the organization that would change this license. It's almost certainly going to be at least a complete architecture license, because we know that Apple are manufacturing their own chips based on the ARM instruction set. So we know that they must have the license at least to do that. But we don't know under what terms. We don't know what they've paid for it. We don't know how long it lasts, so what the renewal terms are and so on. But it is clear that Apple and NVIDIA are less likely to have a clearly synergistic relationship than, say, Apple and ARM Holdings Limited. Look back at the Newton. That was genuinely groundbreaking mobile computing technology. It allowed Apple to enter a new line of business, which was very successful until a change of management and a change of focus meant that it was no longer what they were interested in, but had also allowed ARM to develop their CPUs for mobile applications to the point where when Apple needed a new processor for the iPod portable music player, there was ARM, and there they were ready to support it. When they needed a CPU for the iPhone, ARM was there and had all of the experience in mobile computing. This was a clearly mutually beneficial relationship, which I don't think Apple and NVIDIA are so clearly going to have with each other. And Apple and a hypothetical ARM foundation would be in, I think, a similar relationship where Apple gets the advantages of the developments in the technology, and the foundation gets the experience of integrating with Apple's technology, which they can use for the rest of their partnerships. I think that these would be very clearly beneficial relationships, which don't apply in the Apple NVIDIA sense, where NVIDIA are very much interested in their desktop and server and high performance computing GPUs, and in AI and machine learning applications. And Apple are interested in A, owning the whole widget, and B, low power, portable, but nonetheless computationally efficient portable computing design. So that's ARM and Apple and NVIDIA, but I actually said that the title had something to do with RISC-V, so let's look at RISC-V. I already hear privately, I've been to conferences and talked to people who are in the sort of smaller, like the semiconductor startup line of businesses that are ARM licensees, but are already more like ARM and shops, where they're either evaluating the RISC-V instruction set or already designing products that are hybrid and that use an ARM instruction set chip and a RISC-V instruction set chip on the same board, or are looking to switch to RISC-V. So what is RISC-V? Well, RISC-V is an entirely open source CPU architecture or instruction set that has been around for about a decade. It was started in 2010 by researchers at University of California, Berkeley, who effectively wanted a real-world like instruction set that they could show their students and teach processor design and system architecture on, and that didn't need like licensing costs from ARM or Intel or Motorola, Freescale or whoever, and that was realistic and that could be implemented for very low cost, like, you know, in FPGAs, so like programmable logic. But it has the zero cost because it's open source benefit, and the vendor neutral thing, and the fact that it's designed to be extensible because it's designed to be used by students to explore their own projects. All of these things have lent it to having a significant commercial appearance and like being a reasonable competitor to established CPU architectures in the commercial sphere, to the point where actually ARM's initial reaction to RISC-V's commercial traction was to develop a fear, uncertainty and doubt campaign, which they called RISC-V Understand the Facts, which caused a huge backlash from their own employees and from their ecosystem and from like just generally the technology industry for being so mean and unnecessary. But then they had to react by introducing their zero cost license program, their design start program. Some people predict that RISC-V will do for CPUs what Linux did for operating systems, which is basically sort of making it entirely a commodity so that you can have still like commercial value add. Yeah, there is macOS, there is iOS, there is Windows, and there are still commercial Unix platforms like AIX and Solaris, but they all have to be like something that is better than Linux, because Linux is ubiquitous and is free and has turned the entire market into a commodity market. And it also allows startups to design their stuff much quicker and to iterate much quicker. You know, if you wanted to build an embedded appliance like a smart TV plugin or internet media player or, you know, the smart fridge or whatever your idea is, you can definitely start with Linux and then customize it to fit your application specific needs. You no longer need to think about, oh, how do I design an embedded operating system? And academics are saying that RISC-V will do this for CPUs. So if you need to design application specific hardware, you don't need to think, oh, how do I design a CPU? You think, oh, well, how do I customize RISC-V in order to do what I want? And the world will become the same for like sort of artisanal, small yield CPUs as it is for embedded software using Linux. So having like failed to instill fear and uncertainty and doubt into the market with the Understand the Facts campaign, as I said, ARM introduced their zero cost license. So did MIPS in reaction to RISC-V. The Wave Computing, who are the owners of the MIPS architecture, initially said that they were going to introduce a thing called OpenMIPS, which would be a community foundation for developing and supporting the MIPS architecture. They never did this. They did introduce a zero-cost CPU or instruction set license. And IBM have open-sourced the Power architecture, which is the thing that the Power PC was based on back in the 90s and is used in a lot of their custom computers, including like, you know, big mainframes and the Z series and the like BlueJeans supercomputers. So RISC-V has already started to open the trapdoor at the bottom of the CPU market, and it's likely that it will widen its impact and, you know, just pull the bottom out of this market even further over time. And that, I think, means that a company that wants to own the whole widget will find RISC-V more compelling than ARM very, very soon. And of course, that's what Apple want. They are always saying that the reason that their products are better than their competitors is because of their vertical integration, because they control the whole widget. They'll also get lower cost from using an open source reference than a proprietary reference. If they are paying ARM for a license, it's likely to be millions of dollars a year. And also, it's going to be a lower business risk for Apple to depend on open source technology than on a sometime frenemy single company like Nvidia. I don't think that they're going to sort of wholesale switch from ARM to RISC-V, but I think it's going to be a gradual, like, frog boiling exercise where they'll be introduced via hybrid systems. So maybe a computer that has an ARM CPU for running the applications, but where the baseband is a RISC-V CPU, or where the motion sensor or the security enclave are powered by the RISC-V instruction set. I just think that this is more aligned with where Apple are trying to take their business now than ARM is, and that more aligned than ARM has become in the very short time, the 3 months since Apple announced the transition in their Mac CPUs. So my prediction and the end of this podcast is that I don't believe the ARM CPU era in Macs is going to last as long as the Intel CPU era did. So before WWDC 2035, I expect Apple to either announce, one, that they've just stopped making Macs and there are no more Macs, or two, that future Macs will have the RISC-V CPU instruction set. And either way, I expect this to also affect their portable computers, their mobiles, and their tablets. But it will also affect their watches and any other appliances that they're making in the first half of the next decade. So there we go. As ever, I am very interested in any comments, feedback, questions, anything you want to tell me about this podcast. You can email me grahamlee@acm.org. You can find me on Twitter, iwasleeg, iwasleeg, or you can just leave a comment on the podcast post in the blog. Thank you very much for listening, and I will talk to you next time.